got my back. Thanks to Robert, we got the bell back. All right, so a few announcements. Julie, first announcement.
Don't forget, we can clock an hour behind tomorrow. Daylight savings.
Daylight savings time ends tomorrow.
That's Julie's annual, semi-annual announcement.
Okay, second thing. I'm going to send you an email about this, but there's no class next week. Because they celebrate Veterans Day. So our next class will be in 2 weeks. That'll be the last class of this term. That's the class with the art fair. So you want to bring your, Laura, are you listening? You want to bring your art, okay? So bring your art in 2 weeks. And we'll put it around the room. We'll have a chance to look at it. If you want to wear your art, Sarah, you can wear your art.
Something about somebody.
All right, but if you decide you want to.
So far away.
If you decide you want to. Anyway.
Now, what's the next quarter?
Okay, so also, if you want to get anything into the Life Stories book, you can either, Donna, are you here? So you can email Robert. It's not going to work.
We have one in the
board? Here. Put this one on.
No. Put that one.
Okay, so if you want anything in the Life Stories book, anything at all, email Robert at swt.org, okay, and he will put it in the Life Stories book.
What's the next quarter class?
Okay, so next term's class starts on March 2nd and goes through May, I think, 11th. So 10 weeks, but it starts late. I don't know why we had to do that, but we had to do it for some reason, administrative reason. And that's it's going to be called Consciousness, Science, and the Nature of Being.
Yes.
For the older adult, and it'll be free, okay? That's for some reason we had to do it that way to get it to be two partial semesters or something like that, so it'll be free.
When do we register?
I don't know. I don't know how that happens.
February?
I guess, or maybe not. Maybe you can register at the very beginning. Maybe you can register in December, but it doesn't start till March.
I have a piece of paper there that gives
the
dates next to the water bottles.
That says, okay, let's see. Spring classes, oh yeah. Spring classes display online starting on November 20th.
Oh.
Tuition assistance available. Well, you don't need it. Registration begins Tuesday, December 12th. And the registration dates are December 12th through December 15th. And that's what it says. Okay. Thank you, Amira. Okay. All right, so other announcements. I think that's all. All right, so let's talk about mindfulness a little bit, and then we'll sit. I know. So what we're doing when we become mindful is we're creating a calm, expansive perspective. It's like we expand. We let our usual self relax. We let our thoughts open up so that they can flow freely. We're not holding them in our head. And then our feelings flow freely. We feel our body kind of, like the edges kind of go out and kind of dissolve away. So we just become this open perspective, just this thing without boundaries that has the ability to have experience. And it's calm. We kind of just relax and open, soften and open. And when we do that, we come out of the usual way that we construct ourselves. The me that we make. We just kind of let go of that. We'll go like this, go like this, go like this. And then things happen in that expansiveness that have to do with the usual me. But instead of identifying with those things and trying to do something about those things, get rid of that, change that feeling, change that thought, we simply witness what's happening without attachment to it, without identification with it. It's just worries. It's just heartache. It's just physical pain. It's just whatever it is. There's no attempt to change it. The only attempt, or it's not an attempt really, the only thing we do is we disidentify from it. We're this calm, open awareness in which life is doing what it's doing and we're doing our part, you know, we're doing what we're doing. And it's just, oh, look at that. Look at that. Look at that. And sometimes it's a comedy and sometimes it's a tragedy and mostly it's a tragicomedy. But you just kind of watch it. And when there's a loud sound, instead of resisting it, I get away from, you know, push that away, it's just, okay, now there's a loud sound. And in fact, rather than just labeling it and then not paying attention to it, let's include it in what's happening. Instead of calling it pain, let's see what it is. Just kind of like be curious about it. So this is Buddhism in a nutshell, non-attachment. You don't try to hold on to the good stuff, and you don't try to push away the bad stuff. That's what creates all the suffering. So how does this help? I mean, it's nice when you're sitting. I mean, you know, it's just, oh, yeah, there's the trouble of me in the world, you know, okay. Actually, when you are like this rather than like this, then you, if there is trouble, you see it in a larger context. You see that the world is, and yourself, are multidimensional. So it's hard to be preoccupied with just one aspect. But how does it help more generally? It helps not because you're trying to make it different. Occasionally, you can, from this perspective, do something called skillful means, do something very precise to change something. You can do that, but if you habitually do that, you're not being mindful. If you're habitually doing that, you're doing psychotherapy. Which may or may not be productive. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But the change that happens when you're in this perspective is because you're juxtaposing the end result, the enlightenment you want, the peace and intelligence you want, the expansiveness you want, with whatever's happening. You're not trying to change that. You're just, as Peter Singer in The Untethered Soul says, you kind of fall behind that stuff. And so there's a juxtaposition of whatever contractions or difficulties there are, and this state of acceptance and openness and calmness. And so the two things get associated. And that thing loses its contractedness because it keeps getting paired with something expansive. And so gradually this opens up into this. Not because you're opening it up, just because the two things in contiguity cause either you to get contracted, sometimes, but more generally, when you keep coming to this state, that to open. So the healing, the opening, the releasing happens not because you make it happen. You just create the possibility for it to happen by being that open expansiveness. Remember what Joe Bobro said? He said, what if enlightenment was what you are now? So you assume the goal when you sit, which is you just kind of open up, let go, and live what, experience whatever there is to live. And that creates the situation that eventually everything opens into. So let's sit. Well, Gloria, you had a question?
I hope this isn't a ridiculous question, but from a physics point of view, I mean, we're really physically out there connecting with everybody else?
Okay, this is it depends who you talk to, but one way to look at it is the universe is a wave function. It's just a series of possibilities, and you're contracting the wave function there, and I'm contracting the wave function here, but it's the same kind of whatever it is. It's the same. It's just a different expressions of the same whatever it is. If you want to get really extreme, what's his first name? We had a physicist from UCSB, a string theorist, come.
Gary Horowitz.
Thank you. I keep forgetting Gary's first
string
name.
Theorist.
What?
He's a relativity person, not string theorist.
Oh, he was when he came and talked to us. He
came sure to talk
to
Gary Horowitz?
Twice, yeah.
I've known him for many years.
In any event,
I do too. He is a string expert.
He talked to us about string theory. He did. In any event, what he said was, if you believe in string theory, which is a theory, you know, there's no, they haven't found strings, and they're not gonna, not for a while. But what he said is, the universe is made up of these one-dimensional extended objects called strings. Okay. And the multiplicity we see in the universe is the strings vibrating in different ways. So it's basically one thing, sort of a thing, that because it vibrates differently, gives rise to all these different structures. So that's kind of what you answer that. And, So he left after that. He said, don't ask me about consciousness. I don't know anything about consciousness. I'm not comfortable with that. I'm just going to tell you what I'm going to tell you about physics. And so he left, and then I kind of said to the class, doesn't that kind of sound like what mystics talk about when they talk about it's all one thing or one whatever, one spirit, one consciousness, and it just kind of like expresses itself differently? Anyway. That's a good question, Gloria. All right, let's sit. So the basic idea here is not to try to do anything, not to try to be mindful, not to try to get calm, not to try to expand, not to try to anything, but just to release trying at every level that you become aware of. You're just opening, you're just softening, you're just releasing. And what's left, one more thing about this, which is, typically when we do this, we go to sleep. It's called sleep. Right? As you release, you go to, you lose consciousness. The difference that you're wiring in your brain when you're becoming mindful is as you release tension, as you open, you don't lose consciousness, you gain consciousness. You become more aware of what's happening. But that takes time and you can't make it happen. The first step in that is just release. Softening, opening, release, softening, opening. And then after a while, you start to become interested in what's happening as you go through that. That's it. Turn the lights off. The lights are not good. So to get really fancy here, what we're doing here is wu wei wu. Doing, non-doing. Okay? I learned that in school.
How do you spell?
Wu-wei-wu. W-W-U-W-E-I-W-U. Wu-wei-wu. So here we go. 10 minutes. I think he did that very well. Very peacefully. How are we with the doors? Is it okay with the doors open? If it gets cold, then I kind of sense that some people are cold, so I forgot. Yeah. How is it with natural light? Is it good? Or should I turn the lights on? How many of you want the lights on? Okay, natural light it is. Unless it gets really darker. Okay, we've been progressing through the building blocks of well-being. The acronym HSOPRA, High School OPRA, stands for the first letters of the seven elements of well-being. And we finally arrived at the seventh element. So to review incredibly quickly, H is health. These are the things you need for well-being. S is security. O is optimism. P is pleasure. E is engagement. And part of engagement is meaning. R is relationship, and now we come to A. A is accomplishment. Accomplishment. So why is accomplishment
important? What number is this?
What? It's number 7. So why is accomplishment important for well-being? Why do people run marathons, climb mountains, write poetry, do crossword puzzles, play golf? Those things don't feed you. You generally don't think you're going to get any reward for having run that race, you know, or hit the golf ball or solve the crossword puzzle. Why do people do that? Why do people pick up sculpture, paint it, do any art. Why do chimpanzees with no food reward spend hours trying to solve these physical puzzles, put the thing back in a square, and they just kind of, I've seen pictures of it, they just kind of play. Why are they motivated to do that? Why are we motivated to accomplish things, to master things, to get things done? If you look at, if you consider evolutionary psychology, the answer becomes pretty clear. When you solve that crossword puzzle, what it means is you have worked the world successfully in some way. When you play a good golf game, it means that you have worked the world. You know, you succeeded at doing something in the world. And what that relates to is a feeling of competence to be able to deal with the world to stay alive. So it's very deep in us to want to feel like we can master particular things because they make us feel like we are equal to the challenges of life. Alfred Adler was one of Sigmund Freud's intimate circle in about 1900 in Vienna, and he broke from Freud, like many of Freud's intimate circle did, and started his own kind of psychology called individual psychology. And individual psychology talks about the fact that we were all little once. And because we were little, we all developed an inferiority complex. That is, we weren't as good as the big people, and we also, because we have this inferiority complex, we also have a drive for superiority, a drive to become as good as they are, or better than they are, so that we're equal to them, so that we're secure in the world. And that's a healthy thing that Adams would say. It causes us to do the things that we do. It's a our accomplishment orientation is a compensation for our feelings that we're small, that we're not capable, that we're not equal to the world. But some people over, so some, it, you know, most of us, it's healthy and it drives us to learn to do various things, because not because they themselves pay off, but because they give us a sense that we can do what we need to do, that we're big enough to work the world. Some people overcompensate. That is, they feel at some deep level that they're really weak or small or insignificant. And so they try to demonstrate to themselves and others that they're not. So it's a cover up. The illustration I usually use with the students at City College is, do you go to the gym, you know, and work out? You know, do you notice at the gym that there are some people that live there? That are there 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, or 7 days a week? You know, and they usually look like this, you know? Why are they doing that? Maybe one of them somewhere in LA is getting paid to look like that. But the rest of them are not. Why are they spending all that life energy doing that? Something that is not going to give them any tangible payoff. And don't ever tell those people that I said this, but might it be that if you feel like you're nothing, insignificant, weak, if you get to be like this, nobody is going to take you for insignificant, nothing, weak. So it's an overcompensation, and Adler gave all kinds of illustrations. I guess Lord Byron had polio, and so he learned to be a champion swimmer. There were all these other illustrations he gave of people that overcompensate, the most famous of which probably is Napoleon, right? Felt smaller than everybody else, so he thought he'd conquer the world. so this motive to feel equal to the challenges of life is very deep in us and motivates us to accomplishment, which is a good thing in general. Oh, other overcompensations. Why do people who have $1 billion want to make $5 billion? Ren?
You keep hearing about the little man's complex. Is that a real thing?
That's what Adler said. He said that if you feel less than, you have to demonstrate somehow that you are more than in order to feel equal to.
Yeah.
So, I'm not saying that it's always true, but I think it's frequently true. People who feel less than are motivated to overcome that, to compensate for that. And so you can look at some of these exaggerations as kind of exaggerations of a healthy motive, the motive to be equal to life. But some people kind of, the question is, why do they exaggerate? It's why they get more and more and more when they don't need more and more and more. And the answer might be because at some level they feel less and less and less. So I want to read you a very brief description of a very fascinating experiment that has to do with why. Say again?
Accomplishment. What does that mean?
You'll hear about it in this when I read it.
Okay.
It means being able to do stuff. So the question is why this motive to accomplish is a building block of well-being. Why it's something that is necessary in us, that promotes our well-being. This feeling of I want to be able to do that, whatever it is I set myself out to do. So here's a study that kind of graphically illustrates this. Donald Reidelmeyer and Sheldon Singh looked at the longevity of actors and actresses who had won Academy Awards. How long did Academy Awards award winners live? Celebrities are fascinating in their own right, but these researchers had a theoretical motive behind their investigation. A link between high social status and good health is well established, but its meaning is difficult to unpack. Social status brings with it not only psychological states of satisfaction and accomplishment, but also confounds like income, education, and access to health care. What's responsible for the correlation between status and health? People of higher social status tend to be healthier than people of lower social status. Is it because they have more money and can get better medical care, feed themselves with better food, or live in less noxious environments? What is it that causes people who accomplish more to be healthier? Okay. What's the cause of that? Given that there are all these other factors that come along with accomplishing more. Academy Award winners have high social status and ample material assets, but so do other notable actors and actresses, which means that a comparison between Oscar winners and their peers with respect to longevity starts to pull apart status as a purely psychological characteristic. A comparison between Oscar winners and their peers with respect to longevity starts to pull apart status as a purely psychological characteristic from the other factors with which status is usually associated. That is, if Oscar winners and other prominent actors and actresses have the same material possessions, then the only difference between them is the Oscar winners somehow have higher status. They've accomplished more than the other folks who are similarly well off. So it can't be the access to healthcare or the better food, because all the really good actors and actresses have those things. So the question is there a difference in how long Oscar winners live versus other prominent actors and actresses? Looking at the past 7 decades, Rettelmeyer and Singh, this is 2001 study, so it's fairly recent, identified 235 Academy Award winners. 235 Academy Award winners, 527 actors and actresses who'd been nominated for Oscars but never won, and another 887 control subjects, actors and actresses who had appeared in the same films as the winners and had been born in approximately the same year. So there are three groups: Academy Award winners, Academy Award nominees, and actors and actresses who were born about in the same year as these other groups, but and who had appeared in the same films, but had not been nominated or won Oscars. Okay? All sorts of statistical controls were applied to the survival data for individuals in these groups. For example, the researchers statistically controlled for the number of films in which each actor or actress had appeared, their age when they first appeared in a film, their gender, and their ethnicity. Other analyses were limited just to actors and actresses who had lived at least to age 65. The results were always the same. So it wasn't any of these other factors that were causing the result that I'm about to tell you. Okay? It was, as far as we can see, purely whether you won an Oscar versus whether you were nominated for one versus whether you were in the same film but not weren't nominated. Winners, on average, lived almost 4 years longer than nominees or controls. In fact, the controls lived in general to about age, looks like, the nominees lived slightly longer than the controls, and the Academy Award winners lived way longer than either other group, almost 4 years longer. There was even a modest tendency for multiple Oscar winners, for example, Katharine Hepburn, to live longer than single Oscar winners. So the question is, what's going on here? And what it seems to be, at least from this one study, is that higher level of accomplishment, higher social status, brings with it health and longevity benefits by itself. So accomplishment, if you take this one well-done study as illustrative, accomplishment has something to do with our well-being. Not only the way we think about ourselves, but actually how well we do. It also, on a much more prosaic level, clearly, if you are more accomplished in the world, you get more of the world's goodies, and you get more of the world's health care, and you get organic food, and you get other kinds of things. So accomplishment also brings these other kind of physical rewards with it. So Richard, I wanted to ask you.
So are you distinguishing between accomplishment as assessed by others, or an internal sense of accomplishment that doesn't involve others' approval?
I wasn't distinguishing. I think that it works on two levels. I think probably it certainly works on an internal level. If you feel better about your level of accomplishment, you're less anxious. And if you're less anxious, you're putting less of the stress hormones into your system. So clearly, there's a question mark in healthcare. We know that being anxious and depressed has various physical consequences which make you ill and live less long. That is, you can take a well-functioning system, and by being anxious and depressed, you can hurt it. What we don't know is if there's the opposite direction. That is, if you can take a well-functioning system and do things to make that system work super well, Can you make super immunity, for example? There's some indication that, in fact, you can heighten the usual level of functioning of the physical system, but there's not enough yet. So at the level of, if you don't feel good about yourself, if you feel kind of scared in the world, you're going to be putting fight or flight hormones into your body, you're going to be stressed, you're going to be lessening your health. And if you feel more accomplished, you stop lessening your health and you come back to the normal, healthy way your body evolved to function. So on an internal level, feeling more accomplished at least keeps you at a healthy level of functioning. With regard to other people, they're looking at you as accomplished may cause them to treat you in healthier ways somehow. Why don't you come, you're so eminent, why don't you come and spend a month on my island?
Yeah.
That's a salubrious thing, as a kind of a healthy thing to be on a Bahamian island, with really good food and stuff, So it may be that they treat you better, but it might also be something about the action, the feeling that you get when other people approve of you. That might do something to boost your immunity, to make your system work better. Richard, you're still looking puzzled.
Well, I just wondered, self-acceptance is also an issue, because I think if you feel this anxiousness to accomplish stuff, that creates the stress hormone too.
Yeah.
Whereas if you set up, say in a typical day, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, and you fulfill that for yourself, nobody knows, you have a sense of satisfaction. Yeah. That gives you a sense of accomplishment that's not really based on anybody else giving you praise. It's you accepting what you set out to do, you accomplished it, and you're grateful for that. And
your physiology reflects that.
Right.
That you're, because you're not feeling like, I didn't accomplish it, I'm not worthy of, I'm not succeeding in life.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. And there are people, as we talked about, that never get enough. They never feel okay that they accomplished enough so that they can relax and enjoy who they are. There were a couple of other hands, then we're going to go on.
I'm just thinking of Stephen Hawking, who has exceeded his life expectations because he set himself high goals in physics. But my friend Corinne, Gary's wife, told me also that in the physics department, they never retire. They cannot stay away. They keep coming in and out of retirement.
Yeah, we know that meaning has a lot to do with health and longevity. That people that live more meaningful lives do better. So these two things are kind of put together, because if you accomplish something that, if your sense of accomplishment is directed towards something that's particularly meaningful to you, then you get, seems like, special benefits. He gave another illustration here, which is very, I wasn't going to mention it, but he said he was, this is Chris Peterson, one of the founders of positive psychology. He said, not so long ago, the NBA, the National Basketball Association, had a celebration of their 50-year anniversary, and so they invited the 50 best players of all time to come and celebrate, and 49 of them were still alive. He said that was pretty exceptional. These are people from the old days,
Pete
Maravich. You really want to know? Pete Maravich died. Everybody else was still alive at the time that he wrote this. Gordon.
I was wondering if these people are happier than other people or more satisfied with their life. Just because they live longer isn't really that big of a deal. I mean, it's just 4 years. Yeah. It's nice to live a little longer, but so what,
I know that people that are doing stuff that they consider meaningful are happier, but I don't know if people that accomplish, I don't know if data that shows that people who accomplish more are happier. I think probably because the data is hard, It's polluted. That is, it might make you happy to win an Academy Award, but if you really, really feel bad about yourself, you have to keep winning Academy Awards. So you kind of get two groups of people in there, people that are happy with what they've done and people that are never going to have enough to be happy with what they've done. So how do you tease those things out? Anyway, it's a good question, Gordon. If you find out the answer, let me know. So let's take a couple more hands. Okay. So Gloria and then Paul.
I've done at least 1,000 tax returns. I'm a CPA, and Santa Barbara, I can give you a snapshot, in my opinion, of the what you're talking about with respect to money. And this is just clients that came through my office, but I was in many different offices, so I really got a good cross section. People, I can almost say for the most part, I don't know if I can say always, but I'm going to say a big number. Let's just say 85% of people with a lot of money, well, they're really not that happy. And they're worried about the people who want to steal their money or take their money. And I will tell you, my clients would get at least 5 a day, at least 5 requests for money from every charity. We have, 900 charities? And they were just getting drilled every day, can you give us money? I don't know if that's part of it. The other thing I noticed is that the kids, the parents, usually if they make money doing something, like creating something big, like the name brand or something, and they just keep working. They just keep doing it till they're dying, they're happy. Those guys can be happy, although they're not happy personally. They don't know who their friends are anymore. And but retirement just creams most people. Like if you have a job at a corporation and you can't control whether they're telling you you gotta retire versus the entrepreneur who can keep working until they die. Those guys are happier. Once some job tells you you're gone, you have to retire at 70 or you have to retire at 60, it is not a good thing. And a lot of guys, so the accomplishment picture, but what else? The happiest people are in the middle. The people who give the most to charity are in the middle. My wealthier clients did not give as much to charity as the middle class, and I think they're, again, afraid. You know, they don't know who their friends are. But that's just my experience here, but I've seen pretty much just about everybody in Santa Barbara. I mean, I've worked at the biggest part, I've seen the name brands, you know.
So of the many things I could say about that, because I'm conscious of the time, so I'm only going to say one thing about it. Thank you. That was an interesting comment.
And I got to say, I got to add that I am not talking about that this is a hard and fast rule or I know anything.
Okay, so I guess I'll say two things. One is, it's clear that people who retire and then don't have anything else to substitute for it do badly. So these days they tell you if you're gonna retire, you retire from one thing to something else. You don't do nothing. Second thing about money and happiness, that's a really complicated one. But the one thing I will tell you about that I told you before is, having a lot of money does not make you actually live your life in a happier way. Once you have enough money, more money doesn't make you any happier in terms of how you're going about living your life. But when we ask people how happy you are, when you have more money, you say you're happy. The story you tell yourself gets better as your income gets better, but your actual experience of living doesn't once you have enough.
Okay. Spence, I gotta add, the kids, I don't know if I finished the sentence or not, the kids who, their dad had a lot of money. The dad made the money, right?
Right.
And then they're all born and they've got everything. Those guys are really not happy.
There is, I can say something about that, which is when Mike Csikszentmihalyi looks at kids that have flow versus kids that don't have flow,
Flow means you get into things, you're really engaged, and that's really healthy for you. It turns out that the ones that have flow tend to be sort of in the middle. Blue-collar kids or middle-class kids or even upper-middle-class kids. The ones that don't have flow, that don't get into anything, are kids from the bottom and kids from the top.
At least I would say 70% of the kids got, the dad was dynamic, he made a ton of money, and the kid could never be good enough.
Again, I have something I can't get into, but what you're saying is obvious.
I just want to throw that out.
Okay, so Paula.
Go ahead, I'd rather.
I want you to say which one.
Well, I had a question, which is, can we, so evolutionary biologists talk about the greed gene that's hardwired in our genetics to help us succeed, at least evolutionarily.
Right. The greed, you said. Yeah.
Greed.
Yes, yes.
So how do we tease that out from accomplishment, especially from the goal of accomplishment, especially when we're trying to, when you're trying to understand how somebody who makes a billion wants to make 2 billion.
Okay. Because there are two things at work. The middle of our brain is the greed part. I want more, I want more, I want more of good stuff. That's the reward pathway. That says I can never get enough. If I want more, you know, and so we get addicted to everything, you know, from the middle of the brain says, that was good, I want another one, and I want another one, and I want another one. Because in nature, all that stuff that's good, that is we can perceive as pleasant, is life-giving. We have a lot of stuff that isn't life-giving that gives that same feeling. But that's the middle of the brain. The prefrontal cortex says, that's enough. There are other ways to be happy than the dopamine system, than feeling good, you know, have that lift. The other way to be happy is oxytocin. Talk to other people, touch other people, spend time with other people. So there's two different, the prefrontal cortex can direct us to different kinds of happiness, which is, I got more stuff, versus, isn't it wonderful to spend time with you? And the prefrontal cortex keeps us balanced.
Yes,
understand? So otherwise, we'd be totally dominated by, where's the next food, where's the next food, where's the next food, like some animals are, you know, because they don't have the other possibility. Okay, anyway, I want to tell you one more thing, and then I want to show you this video, okay, which I've been stalling about for 3 weeks. Okay, so the one more thing I want to tell you is, and this is thanks to Ann Ridvers, who gave me The Search for Happiness, November this year, it just came out, National Geo. I used to subscribe and I feel bad that I don't, but anyway, Ann gave this to me and I read the article on happiness, and what it said, they gave 3 illustrative countries that always rate high in the happiness ratings. The Gallup rating and the World Happiness Report rating, the ones, the big ratings that happen around the world. So they gave the illustration of 3 countries, and they rated high for 3 different reasons in terms of happiness.
Very different countries.
Yeah, so the one country was Costa Rica, and they rated high because of positive affect, because of positive emotion. Basically, because they enjoy life and each other. So that's one route to happiness is pleasure and positive emotion, which we talked about. That's Costa Rica, and they rate very high because of that. Second country was Denmark. Okay, and Denmark rates very high when it comes to happiness because of engagement. Because in Denmark, you get to do stuff you want to do a lot. You get to do stuff you like to do. It's set up so that you can pursue your interests. So the P and the E are two different routes. But there was a third country in there that had to do exclusively with accomplishment. There wasn't so much positive emotion, and there wasn't so much engagement in that country. In fact, pretty low. But accomplishment was off the charts. That country is Singapore. It is said that the Asian countries, the emphasis is so much on accomplishment that what makes people feel happy about their lives when they fill out these surveys is how well they have done financially. Okay? So Singapore is an example of a country where the emphasis is on get rich. Okay?
and they've done very well with that.
So you're saying that if a Singapore person moved to Denmark, they might not be so happy.
Right, because the taxes are too high and they can't accomplish what they are programmed to accomplish. And they would definitely be not happy in Costa Rica because you're supposed to be working, guys. Why are you dancing, you know? Okay, so having said all that, so I don't have much more to say about accomplishment, just that it's watching in yourself, it's a healthy motive because it relates to the, when you accomplish something, when you clean out your desk, you get it nice and, you know, or your kitchen or something, you know the feeling that you get when you finally do something, you accomplish something? You get a really good feeling. That feeling goes very deep in you evolutionarily. It goes to the feeling of, yes, I'm equal to the world. I can work the world.
Is that why we make lists and we lost
5%? Say again?
Is that why we like making lists and crossing things?
Yes! Absolutely. Because it means we're mastering the world. The world is not going to eat us. Okay? All right, so now, what we need to do now, is set the room up for a video. Thank you, and I will take this. Some of you may remember this because I did show it once. I think it's totally worth seeing again. But it's an extremely inspiring video. It was actually given at a TEDx talk. And so TEDx are these spin-off conferences. There are hundreds and hundreds all over the place. They're in Santa Barbara and probably thousands at this point. What they do is they video these things and then they show them to the central TED people, and they select a few of them to be posted on the main TED website. And this was one of those that was selected and was posted on the main TED website, and 17.5 million people have seen it since. So this is the guy who directs the Harvard Study of Adult Development, which he's going to tell you, but I'll tell you a little more detail. In 1938, researchers at Harvard decided to study people who were who were sophomores, I think, at that point, just entered Harvard, and study them long term to see what happened to them in their lives. So they gave them all kinds of tests and questionnaires, and then they followed them throughout their lives to see why lives turn out the way that they turn out. They also said, so they had 300 or 400 of these Harvard students. Now, these Harvard students, in 1938, these Harvard students were universally New England upper-class WASP. There was no ethnic diversity. They were all male. Okay, so that was that group, privileged group. They also studied a great, I don't know how many hundred, 800? Contemporaneous, that is at the same age, inner city Boston kids. Kids from the lowest social classes. And they gave them the same tests and they followed them throughout their lives. Okay? To see, they were the control group. You know, they were to see what the similarities and differences were. One thing he's not going to tell you is the Harvard men, because World War II was happening, the Harvard men typically either left Harvard and then came back, or finished Harvard and then went into the service. And when they came back from the war, they were asked to write, as part of this study, they were asked to write about their wartime experience. And they did. And then much later, in the early part of this century, the early 2000s, researchers went back and they read those little essays that the guy that read them said, I must say they had good penmanship in those days. Very easy to read. So, probably good grammar too, he's a Harvard student. But in any event, they read these and they blindly scored them, that is, they didn't know the names. They scored each one for optimism or pessimism, how they described their wartime experiences. And then they saw how long the people lived and how well they did physically. I don't know if they did the well how long they lived, but they saw how what their physical health was. And it turned out that in their 30s and early 40s, there was no difference between the people that had pessimistic explanations for what had happened during the war and optimistic explanations. By the way, optimistic explanations were stuff like, you know, I was fortunate to be assigned to this group versus that group. That's an optimistic statement. Or pessimistic statement is, I really hated the army and did everything I could. You know, so they look for positive and negative words to score optimism and pessimism. So it turned out that by about age 50, there was a fairly substantial difference in the health of people who had, in their early 20s, written optimistic versus pessimistic statements. And that difference became strongest, I think, about age 55, when you saw a kind of dramatic difference between the pessimists and the optimists, who on other measures were equal, right? Because they were all Harvard privileged students. But optimism and pessimism had something to do in this study with how healthy people became later in life. There's a lot of research in positive psychology which shows that early optimism predicts both health and longevity. Which I told you that a little bit when I talked to you about optimism. But I wanted to tell you from the Harvard study that was part of it. But that's not what he's going to talk about. Okay? So he's going to talk about what the Harvard study is still going on. The third director was George Valiant, who many of you have heard of, a very famous guy. He's the fourth director, this guy. So it's still happening, this study. So what did they find?
So who is this guy? Who are we seeing?
We're going to see a man named Robert Waldinger. So here we go.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. There it is. Good. Okay. So here we go. Do you want the closed captioning on this, Ken?
Yes.
Got it. I think it's going to be on. Yes, it's going to be on. Good. Here we go.
What keeps us healthy and happy as we go through life? If you were going to invest now in your future best self, where would you put your time and your energy? There was a recent survey of millennials asking them what their most important life goals were, and over 80% said that a major life goal for them was to get rich. And another 50% of those same young adults said that another major life goal was to become famous. And we're constantly told to lean in to work, to push harder and achieve more. We're given the impression that these are the things that we need to go after in order to have a good life. Pictures of entire lives of the choices that people make and how those choices work out for them, those pictures are almost impossible to get. Most of what we know about human life, we know from asking people to remember the past. And as we know, hindsight is anything but 20/20. We forget vast amounts of what happens to us in life, and sometimes memory is downright creative. But what if we could watch entire lives as they unfold through time? What if we could study people from the time that they were teenagers all the way into old age to see what really keeps people happy and healthy? We did that. The Harvard study of adult development may be the longest study of adult life that's ever been done. For 75 years, we've tracked the lives of 724 men. Year after year, asking about their work, their home lives, their health, and of course asking all along the way without knowing how their life stories were going to turn out. Studies like this are exceedingly rare. Almost all projects of this kind fall apart within a decade because too many people drop out of the study, or funding for the research dries up, or the researchers get distracted, or they die, and nobody moves the ball further down the field. But through a combination of luck and the persistence of several generations of researchers, this study has survived. About 60 of our original 724 men are still alive, still participating in the study, most of them in their 90s. And we are now beginning to study the more than 2,000 children of these men. And I'm the fourth director of the study. Since 1938, we've tracked the lives of two groups of men. The first group started in the study when they were sophomores at Harvard College. They all finished college during World War II, and then most went off to serve in the war. And the second group that we followed was a group of boys from Boston's poorest neighborhoods. Boys who were chosen for the study specifically because they were from some of the most troubled and disadvantaged families in the Boston of the 1930s. Most lived in tenements, many without hot and cold running water. When they entered the study, all of these teenagers were interviewed, they were given medical exams. We went to their homes and we interviewed their parents. And then these teenagers grew up into adults who entered all walks of life. They became factory workers and lawyers and bricklayers and doctors, one president of the United States. Some developed alcoholism, a few developed schizophrenia. Some climbed the social ladder from the bottom all the way to the very top, and some made that journey in the opposite direction. The founders of this study would never in their wildest dreams have imagined that I would be standing here today, 75 years later, telling you that the study still continues. Every 2 years, our patient and dedicated research staff calls up our men and asks them if we can send them yet one more set of questions about their lives. Many of the inner city Boston men ask us, why do you keep wanting to study me? My life just isn't that interesting. The Harvard men never ask that question. To get the clearest picture of these lives, we don't just send them questionnaires. We interview them in their living rooms. We get their medical records from their doctors. We draw their blood. We scan their brains. We talk to their children. We videotape them talking with their wives about their deepest concerns. And when, about a decade ago, we finally asked the wives if they would join us as members of the study, many of the women said, you know, it's about time. So what did we learn? What are the lessons that come from the tens of thousands of pages of information that we've generated on these lives? Well, the lessons aren't about wealth or fame or working harder and harder. The clearest message that we get from this 75-year study is this: good relationships keep us happier and healthier, period. We've learned three big lessons about relationships. The first is that social connections are really good for us, and that loneliness kills. It turns out that people who are more socially connected to family, to friends, to community, are happier, they're physically healthier, and they live longer than people who are less well connected. And the experience of loneliness turns out to be toxic. People who are more isolated than they want to be from others find that they are less happy, their health declines earlier in midlife, their brain functioning declines sooner, and they live shorter lives than people who are not lonely. And the sad fact is that at any given time, more than 1 in 5 Americans will report that they're lonely. And we know that you can be lonely in a crowd, and you can be lonely in a marriage. So the second big lesson that we learned is that it's not just the number of friends you have, and it's not whether or not you're in a committed relationship, but it's the quality of your close relationships that matters. It turns out that living in the midst of conflict is really bad for our health. High conflict marriages, for example, without much affection, turn out to be very bad for our health, perhaps worse than getting divorced. And living in the midst of good, warm relationships is protective. Once we have followed our men all the way into their 80s, we want to look back at them at midlife and to see if we could predict who's going to grow into a happy, healthy octogenarian and who wasn't. And when we gathered together everything we knew about them at age 50, it wasn't their middle-aged cholesterol levels that predicted how they were going to grow old. It was how satisfied they were in their relationships. The people who were the most satisfied in their relationships at age 50 were the healthiest at age 80. And good, close relationships seem to buffer us from some of the slings and arrows of getting old. Our most happily partnered men and women reported in their 80s that on the days when they had more physical pain, their moods stayed just as happy. But the people who were in unhappy relationships, on the days when they reported more physical pain, it was magnified by more emotional pain. And the third big lesson that we learn about relationships and our health is that good relationships don't just protect our bodies, they protect our brains. It turns out that being in a securely attached relationship to another person in your 80s is protective. That the people who are in relationships where they really feel they can count on the other person in times of need, those people's memories stay sharper longer. And the people in relationships where they feel they really can't count on the other one, those are the people who experience earlier memory decline. And those good relationships, they don't have to be smooth all the time. Some of our octogenarian couples could bicker with each other day in and day out. But as long as they felt that they could really count on the other when the going got tough, those arguments didn't take a toll on their memories. So, this message that good, close relationships are good for our health and well-being, this is wisdom that's as old as the hills. Why is it so hard to get and so easy to ignore? Well, we're human. What we really like is a quick fix, something we can get that'll make our lives good and keep them that way. Relationships are messy and they're complicated, and the hard work of tending to family and friends, it's not sexy or glamorous. It's also lifelong. It never ends. The people in our 75-year study who were the happiest in retirement were the people who had actively worked to replace workmates with new playmates. Just like the millennials in that recent survey, many of our men, when they were starting out as young adults, really believed that fame and wealth and high achievement were what they needed to go after to have a good life. But over and over, over these 75 years, our study has shown that the people who fared the best were the people who leaned into relationships with family, with friends, with community. So what about you? Let's say you're 25, or you're 40, or you're 60. What might leaning into relationships even look like? Well, the possibilities are practically endless. It might be something as simple as replacing screen time with people time, or lightening up a stale relationship by doing something new together, long walks or date nights, or reaching out to that family member who you haven't spoken to in years, because those all too common family feuds take a terrible toll on the people who hold the grudges. I'd like to close with a quote from Mark Twain. More than a century ago, he was looking back on his life, and he wrote this: "There isn't time, so brief is life, for bickerings, apologies, heartburnings, callings to account. There is only time for loving, and but an instant, so to speak, for that. The good life is built with good relationships." Thank you.
So that related to the relationship one, not to the accomplishment one, obviously, but I didn't get to show it to you last week. So I have kind of one last thing that I want to do on this
high school opera thing, which is the following. And you don't have to do this if you don't want to. You might want to, but if you do want to do it, you're going to need a little bit of paper and pencil, or pen or something.
By the way, we're finding out more and more how responsive the body is and how plastic the brain is, and so you can change at any age, any pattern, and you can see remarkably quick results. Okay. So here's the grading scale.
Next week. Last week. So we have this. Something would happen last week. So, what would you find out?
Okay, so there's the rating scale. So what we're going to do is put down HSOPERA. Okay. And then what you do without thinking very much about it, because you'll kind of, you know, just kind of the first thing that comes to your mind. So HSOPERA.
Put it down where?
Just on the top of the page.
On top?
Yeah.
H what?
HSOPERA. E-R-A. And what you're going to do is put one of these underneath each letter for how well you're doing with regard to that aspect. So let's say for pleasure, you're kind of in the middle, you put this one, okay? So do it, okay? Nobody's going to see this but you.
What's the first one?
H, health. Health.
And S?
So you, just for each one, you kind of put one of these. So
what's S?
You can do, if you want, you can do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but this is more or less.
Okay? What's S? I forget.
Security.
P?
Okay, so health, security. Okay, let's do them together. Health, put a thing. Put a circle for health. Put a circle for security. How secure you feel. Put a circle for O. How optimistic you feel you are. And don't, you know, the first thing that occurs to you is usually what you put. Go circle for how optimistic you are. Okay. A circle for how much pleasure you feel in life. A circle for how engaged you are, that is, how into what you're doing you are. That you want to do, not the stuff you have to do. The stuff you want to do. Okay. How into the stuff you want to do you are. How your relationships are. How much good relationship you have. And how much you feel you're accomplishing your goals. How accomplished you feel. So you know what your homework is. The idea is you turn these, you want to migrate these things over here. Okay? All right. So let's break for the week. Don't come next week, but in 2 weeks, we're going to kind of change. We're going to kind of go up. Okay. You'll see. Come in 2 weeks.